Martyrs and Missionaries is a production of Revive Studios. You're listening to Martyrs and Missionaries. I'm Elise, and in every episode, I'll bring you a new martyr and or missionary, the called and the brave. In this episode, we're covering part two of the father of modern missions, William Carey. Before we get started, I want to let you know this is the last episode until after the summer because we are going back to visit friends and family and speak at churches in the States this summer. And so don't panic if you don't see an episode for a couple months. I'll be back in August. When we last left our people, William Carey had just gotten remarried to Charlotte, and the Serampore mission was just getting started. The Serampore trio was together. You had Hannah and Joshua Marshman and William Ward and, of course, William Carey. One of the very first things that Hannah Marshman did when her family arrived was to set up a school for young ladies. She took a special interest in the plight of the Hindu women whose role in society was exceedingly marginalized. She said the women are in general very dirty, almost as unmoved as Stoics. Boiling their rice and bathing their children is nearly all they do. The first school became a model for others, and in 1826, Carey reported that 14 such schools had been established in India. Next to Bible teaching and preaching, Carey considered education to be the next best means of reaching people for the gospel. He wrote to his son, "I consider schools as one of the most effectual means of spreading the light of the gospel throughout the world." Carey took this responsibility very seriously. He didn't mess around when it came to creating a curriculum. He wasn't just hodgepodging something together. Since the Enlightenment period, educational theory had always separated religion and science, and he believed that only as Hindu students were instructed in the unity of the truth, which embraced all facets of reality, could the pagan superstitions and mythologies of their faulty worldview be exposed. He wanted them to become curious and to think about the natural world and deeper theological truths, and their curriculum included spelling and grammar and math, composition, history, geography, the natural sciences, and ethics courses. By 1817, 103 of these schools were operating in India with an average attendance of 6,700 students. And there were some difficulties because initially it was believed that women who were educated would become widows shortly after they were married. So little girls were not allowed to be near their brothers when they were studying their work. Others thought that their kids would be kidnapped and shipped off to England. But even with these setbacks, the schools were a massive success. And in the midst of these initial schools getting off the ground, Carey is asked to be a professor at Fort William College in Calcutta, only he's not called a professor, but only a tutor because he is considered a dissenter. He's not an Anglican, and so his salary was cut in half. His position was not as respected. This is a school for the Sons of East India Company officials, and it's modeled after Oxford and Cambridge. He's asked to serve as their tutor of the Bengali language, and that's a position he comes to absolutely love. At first, he's worried because he thought it would take away from his translation work, but if anything, it actually enhanced it. He was able to keep his nose buried in Bengali and then get paid for it while translating the New Testament. And then later, in 1807, because of all this prestigious work he was doing in education, he was granted a much-deserved honorary doctorate. And then putting all of these years of educational expertise together, in 1818, the Serampore Mission opened Serampore College, which served to train indigenous pastors, but also provided education in the arts and sciences to anyone who wanted to join. And the school was given a royal charter by Danish King Frederick VI less than 10 years later, which gave it the distinction of being the first degree-granting institution in Asia. And at this college, Carey served as the professor of divinity and a lecturer on botany and zoology. And 2 years after this college opens, he founds the Agra Horticultural Society of India, also in Calcutta. He's ahead of the curve because this is like 2 or 3 years before the big fancy one in England even opens. He loves botany in his spare time. I don't know how he had spare time, but he does. He manages to get all this stuff done, I guess. But he was widely respected enough as a botanist that when William Roxburgh, whom we all know as the founding father of Indian botany, I had no idea, but this guy needed to be away, Carey was entrusted to care for the Calcutta Botanical Garden. Also, the genus Carea, a flowering plant, is named for him. Carrying on his love of botany, he had this absolutely beautiful garden at the mission, which he adored. And it seems his coworkers really didn't quite share his love of it because he joked that after he died, Marshman would permit the cows to run loose in his garden. But his ability to continue pursuing something he loved reminds me of Lilias Trotter, who thought she would have to give up painting to go into mission work, but in fact, she still found time to paint, and arguably her most beautiful works of art were far more meaningful than they would have been if she had remained in England. And I think of it as one of those little graces that God gives his people when they give up seemingly everything to follow his call. But switching from his passion for botany and education into his passion for translation and languages, the man was an absolute beast. He was already fluent in many Western languages before he even came to India, and he jumped into studying Bengali with immense passion. His advice to learning a language was to live it and to breathe it, to make it your own root and branch. Be curious, learning the construction, the parts of speech, and even the accents of the native speakers. And as diligent of a studier as he was, Bengali was a challenging language to translate the Bible into. It was difficult to find the right verbal equivalents for biblical concepts like love and repent. Even devil and the son of God required careful translation. Carey wrote, "If I say shaitan, that is devil, they do not understand who I mean unless I add, he is a bara haram tadi, though which used to signify a rascal, yet in plain English it is the son of a whore, and if I say the son of God, they can scarcely 1 in 100 understand the word for son. But if I say God's boy, that is exactly conformable to their idiom. This sometimes discourages me much, but blessed be God." But by 1796, the first edition of the Bengali New Testament had been completed, although it seems like it wasn't until William Ward had joined the mission that they were able to begin printing them in 1801. The very first copy Carey placed on the communion table, and all the mission gathered around to give thanks to God for its completion. Ward wrote back home, "To give a man a New Testament who had never seen one, who had been reading lies as the word of God, to give him these everlasting lines, which angels would be glad to read, this is my blessed work." Joshua compared the first 2,000 printed copies to 2,000 missionaries being sent out. One of these original copies made it to the city of Dhaka, some 320 kilometers away in modern-day Bangladesh. 17 years later, when missionaries arrived to that city, they found that several Hindu villages had abandoned their idols and were waiting for someone to come explain the words they had read in the frayed pages of one of these New Testaments, which they had kept protected in a wooden box. And isn't it so interesting that how many of these accounts exist all over the world? And it reminds me of the Buddhist monks that Gladys Aylward stumbled across, who had this little gospel tract. I think it was like part of the Gospel of John. And they had been waiting for years for someone to come explain it to them. Just really cool to see how God works something out years later. Before Carey's death, the Bengali New Testament had been revised 8 times. The Old Testament was originally published in segments, but had been revised 5 times. And he had compiled a Bengali dictionary, which was insanely helpful because efforts to adjust Bengali into a written language and not just spoken had only begun in earnest within his lifetime. But Carey's plans for translating didn't end at Bengali. He had really big dreams outside of India itself. He wrote back to John Ryland in 1803, "We have it in our power, if our means would be for it, in the space of about 15 years to have the word of God translated and printed in all languages of the East. Our situation is such as to furnish us with the best assistance from natives of the different countries. We can have types of all the different characters cast here. On this great work, we have fixed our eyes. Whether God will enable us to accomplish it or any considerable part of it is uncertain." The team back home thought it was a little bit outlandish. Fuller even said, "By aiming at too much, we may accomplish the less." But they helped anyway, and then Fuller traveled all over Britain collecting the funds. They even collected some $6,000 from the U.S. By the time of Marshman's death, the team had translated the Bible into some 40-odd languages. Carey wrote a letter to Fuller explaining the process. "I never suffer a single word or a single mode of construction to pass without examining it, and seeing through it, I read every proof sheet twice or thrice myself and correct every letter with my own hand. Brother Marshman and I compose with the Greek or the Hebrew, and Brother Ward reads every sheet. 3 of the translations, namely Bengali, Hindustani, and Sanskrit, I translate with my own hand. I constantly avail myself of the help of the most learned native and should think it criminal not to do so, but I do not commit my judgment to any one." When beginning a translation into a new language, Carey always started with Matthew, Acts, and Romans because he thought that these were more than sufficient to lay a foundation for the faith. Fuller's concerns were somewhat true, though, because as impressive as the volume of translations are, they were not always the most accurate to the original text and did not always render well into the target language. However, they did lay the foundation for others to come behind them and create more effective, refined additions. But in 1812, after a particularly hard start to the year, which involved five funerals, including an infant, the building which housed the printing press, and all of the translation works was destroyed in a fire. Some of the works were saved and the printing presses were moved in time, but they couldn't save all the typefaces for the unique languages they had made in-house. The equivalent of $1 million and much of Carey's life work went up in flames. Carey had been away in Calcutta when the fire broke out, and one of the missionaries related what he saw as Carey walked through the ruins. The scene was indeed affecting, the long printing office reduced to a mere shell, the yard covered with burnt paper. Carey walked with me over the smoking ruins. The tears stood in his eyes. He said, "In one night, the labors of years are consumed. How unsearchable are the divine ways. I had lately brought some things to the utmost perfection I could and contemplated the mission with perhaps too much self-congratulations. The Lord has laid me low that I may look more simply to him." He also wrote back to his nephew Eustace in England, "This is a heavy blow as it will stop our printing the scriptures for a long time. 12 months of hard labor will not reinstate us, not to mention the loss of property, manuscripts, etc., which we shall scarcely ever surmount. I wish to be still and know that the Lord is God and to bow to his will in everything. He will no doubt bring good out of this evil and make it to promote his interests. But at present, the providence is exceedingly dark." And then writing back to his family in England, he said, "Much ground must be labored over again, and I have suffered most, but we are not discouraged. We are chastened and not killed, cast down but not destroyed, perplexed but not in despair." When they heard the news, Christians from all over the world rallied to support the mission, and the funds came flowing in. They were able to get going again and even increase the rate of production, which lessened the blow just a little bit. And speaking of Christians all over the world, the Baptist Missionary Society had sparked an interest in creating other like-minded societies. The London Missionary Society was founded in 1795, the Church Missionary Society in 1799, the Congregationalists in New England got started in 1810 and sent out their first missionaries, among whom were Adon Iram and Anne Judson. The British Methodists and General Baptists were sending out people by 1816. By the 1830s, there were 14 missionary societies in England alone. Carey called this the first wave of a new Reformation. And in this spirit, the Serampore Mission was very much so open to working across the denominational aisle, so to speak, with other evangelicals. Their stated goal was to cherish a Catholic spirit towards them and to engage in ready cooperation with them in everything which did not require a sacrifice of religious principle. A Catholic here means universal, not Roman Catholic, because they, of course, had standards. They did have difficulty working with the Anglicans because they were often prejudiced against and felt that the Anglicans looked down their noses at them because they were dreadful dissenters, and worse, they were Baptist dissenters. Carey had his own issues with the Anglicans and would actually deny them communion because of their stance on baptism, which others in the mission felt may have been a bridge too far, but it's what he did. But despite his strong stance on baptism, he wrote to Fuller proposing an ecumenical meeting of missionaries to discuss global strategy. He thought it would be nice if they held one every 10 years, and Fuller called it a pleasing dream but turned it down because he felt that it would do more harm than good. Now, interestingly, Carey proposed that the first meeting take place in 1810. Exactly 100 years later, in 1910, the Edinburgh Missionary Conference was held for that very thing.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Sadly, if you are a diehard Andrew Fuller fan like me, all good things must come to an end, and Fuller does eventually die in 1815. He had held the rope for the mission for over 20 years. He was absolutely amazing, but all the people who were now serving on the board for the society had no relationship with Carey at all, or apparently with Marshman or Ward either, because they accused the three of them of filling their coffers instead of focusing on the mission. Now, clearly, they were obtuse because there is no way you could look at the work of the mission and think that, but they did. And Carey quipped that if he were to die on the spot, his wife would scarcely have the money for a coffin. Virtually all of their money was poured back into the mission. Around this same time, as communications are beginning to fray, a bunch of young bucks arrive from England, and they hate just about everything about the mission. They hate the communal living, and they think that Carey is too controlling, among other things. I'm not sure what all their complaints were, but they had a lot of complaints. Now, I imagine they would have been told about the living arrangements ahead of time. They would have, that's kind of like a selling point, but they weren't fans. So they all, including Carey's nephew Eustace, set up a rival mission in Calcutta. And it is a mess. It would take a long time to get into with the back and forth and all of that. But essentially, the board was requiring that every mission decision be run by through them. They couldn't do anything without the approval of the mission, which, of course, makes no sense because they're in England and they're in India and it's letters and there's just no way you could do anything effectively. And they were really putting the squeeze on them and just trying to dictate everything they did. And so it was absolutely impossible for the Serampore mission to acquiesce to these demands. So Carey and the mission cut ties in 1828, and they would remain an independent entity for the rest of his life. They do eventually come back, but that's not for a while in the future. And all this infighting really took its toll on Carey's health. He hated what it did to their Christian witness. And in addition to all these other problems, the mission also brought with it an apostate-to-be named William Adam. Now, William must have been like the number one name for baby boys in like the 18th century because there are so many Williams. So for the purpose of clarity, we're going to call him Adam. Adam arrived in India in 1817 and came under the influence of a Hindu scholar, a really smart guy, a Brahmin who had liked the Serampore trio and was an Indian reformer. He abhorred infanticide and sati or sati, which we'll talk about in a minute. But he disagreed with all the tenets of the faith, the Trinity, the person and work of Christ, the inerrancy of Scripture. And so Adam took up this view as well, and a few years later, Carrier lamented, "Brother Adam now denies or expresses doubt equal to a denial of the proper deity of Christ. He is now engaged with Raman Roy," who is this Brahmin scholar, "in writing against the Trinity." Adam soon organized a Unitarian church in Calcutta, which Roy attended. He also established a Unitarian press as a counterfoil to the publishing enterprise of his former colleagues at Serampore. The Serampore mission came to call him the second fallen Adam and were woefully astonished that a Brahmin had converted a missionary. And they saw these two as having cut out the entire heart of the gospel itself. As Marshman put it, "If Jesus were only a great human teacher and not also the very Son of God, at one with the Father and his eternal deity, then he is neither worthy of our worship nor able to rescue us from this terrible plight of sin. Moreover, it was not possible to divorce the teaching of Jesus from the historical events of his life, death, and resurrection, which the Bible interprets as God's decisive salvation act on behalf of fallen humanity. Without these, what is the gospel?" I've been hinting around about Carey's involvement in social reform, so let's go ahead and get into that. I mentioned in the previous episode that he hated the slave trade. He, along with many other Christians, boycotted sugar from the West Indies because it was procured with slave labor. When he set foot in India, the raw evils of humanity were not so neatly packed away as they were in the West. So many horrible evils were social norms in India. People would routinely drag their elderly and dying relatives to the Ganges to die of exposure and starvation, because death near the Ganges was believed to promise salvation and would break the cycle of rebirth. And it's really quite sad because the best they can hope for is that it breaks, that there's nothing, that it's just this black emptiness in life. And this is actually still practiced in the city of Varanasi, although more humanely, old people will essentially move into these Spartan apartments, pray and study the texts, and just wait to die. It's incredibly sad. And I looked to see if there was any missionaries that happened to be working there among them. And it seems that during British rule, of course, there were some and they kind of left. And I think now there are Catholic missions there, but I couldn't get a read on whether there were any Protestants. So if anyone happens to know, just shoot me a message. I'm a little curious. In India at this time, they also regularly practiced infanticide. If a baby was born sickly or deformed, they were left out in the jungle to die. Carrie and a friend came across the skull of a baby while walking one day, and the skull was the only thing left because the rest had been eaten by ants. And they also practiced twin infanticide, much like they did in Nigeria during Mary Slessor's day, but for a different reason. Indians would give one of their twins up as a sacrifice offered back to the Ganges, and they would be given to crocodiles. And they also had this thing about lepers, which is rough because even today, 60% of the world's leprosy cases are in India. Carrie wrote about a leper he saw once. A pit about 10 cubits in depth was dug, and a fireplace at the bottom of it. The poor man rolled himself and struggled for the purpose of getting out of the pit. His mother and sister, however, thrust him in and again, and thus a young man, who to all appearance might have survived several years, was cruelly burned to death. I find that the practice is not uncommon in these parts, taught that a violent end purifies the body and ensures transmigration into a healthy new existence, while natural death by disease results in 4 successive births and a 5th as a leper again. The leper, like the even more wretched widow, has always courted suicide. The Serampore mission opened their doors to these lepers and provided them with medicine and a chance to hear the gospel. And all of these horrendous practices were protected under British rule because those who practiced them claimed they were following their sacred texts, so they were just practicing their religion, and the British government saw little need to change this status quo. However, when it came to infanticide, the Governor General of Calcutta asked Carrie to investigate how many of these children were being sacrificed, and they very quickly found out that 100 children per year on one island, 100 kilometers south of the city where the Ganges opens up into the Bay of Bengal, were being sacrificed. The Governor General quickly shut down this practice. This is one of these first crimes against humanity which were outlawed in India, and it paved the way for the banning of widow burning. Widow burning killed thousands of women each year, and those who practiced it believed they would bring blessings to their family and would maybe even move themselves closer to breaking the cycle of reincarnation for themselves. Carrie had the chilling experience of witnessing at least one of these immolations, and he wrote back to England, "We were near a village. Being evening, we got out of the boat to walk when we saw a number of people assembled on the riverside. I asked them what they were met for, and they told me to burn the body of a dead man. I inquired if his wife would be burned with him, and they answered yes and pointed to the woman. She was standing by the pile, which was made up of large billets of wood, about 2 feet high, 4 feet long, and 2 wide, and on top of which lay the dead body of her husband. Her nearest relation stood near her, and near her was a small basket of sweetmeats. I asked them if this was the woman's choice or if she'd been brought here by an improper influence. They answered that it was perfectly voluntary. I talked till reasoning was of no use, and then began to exclaim with all my might against what they were doing, telling them this was a shocking murder. They told me this was a great act of holiness and acted in a very surly manner, that if I did not like to see it, I might go further off. I told them I would not go, but I was determined to stay and see the murder, and that I should certainly bear witness of it at the tribunal of God. I exhorted the woman not to throw her life away, to fear nothing, for no evil would follow her refusal to burn. No sooner was the fire kindled than all the women set up a great shout. It was impossible to have heard the woman had she groaned or even cried aloud on account of the mad noise of the people, and it was impossible for her to stir or struggle on account of the bamboo, which were held down on her like levers of a printing press. We made much objection to their using these bamboos and insisted that this was using force to prevent the woman from getting up when the fire burned her. But they declared that it was only done to keep the pile from falling down. We could not bear to see more, but left, exclaiming loudly against the murder and full of horror at what we had seen." Carrie collected more and more of these instances and publicized them widely throughout India and England, and eventually in 1829, the practice was outlawed. Carrie was asked to translate the law into Bengali for distribution throughout the country, and it's the only time in his life that he ever skipped church. He passed his Sunday sermon off to another and got to work, believing that for every moment he delayed, a life was in danger. By the time this law passes, William had been married 3 times. His second wife, Catherine, struggled with health problems throughout her life, and towards the end of her life, she was a complete invalid and had to be carried everywhere that she went, and she died in 1821 at the age of 60. Carrie broke the news to his old friend John Riley in this way, "We have been married 13 years and 3 weeks, during all which season I believe we had a great share of conjugal happiness as was ever enjoyed by mortals." In his birthday letter to Jabez, he confessed, "I am exceedingly lonely. My house is to be a wilderness, and I am often very low in my spirit. I hope you will never fail to pray for me." Charlotte was without a doubt the great love of his life, like because although he did marry again and this woman cared for him in his old age and they were happy, whenever he died, she was given like her choice of English books she could take, which was worth a considerable sum, but he requested to be buried next to Charlotte. In the last few years of his life, he suffered many ailments, which severely enfeebled him. And within the year of his death, he wrote to his sisters, "This is the last letter you are at all likely to receive from me. The will of the Lord be done. Adieu till I meet you in a better world." In the last month of his life, he spent his time writing, accepting visitors, and walking in his garden. And he reflected on his life while talking with a friend, saying, "When I compare things as they are now in India with what they were when I first came here, I see that a great work has been accomplished, but how it has been accomplished, I know not." I was talking with a friend a while back, and she asked me if I thought that Carrie knew he was setting up a legacy. I told her I didn't know because I hadn't gotten that far in the story yet, but later on I read this snippet. In 1811, a Burman missionary passing through Serampore referred to the Serampore trio as Peter, James, and John. Concerning Carrie, he wrote, "He is a very superior man and appears to know nothing at all about it." And I think we get the answer to that question as he's nearing the end. A fellow missionary had come to visit him, and as the man was leaving, Carrie said to him, "You've been talking about Dr. Carrie, Dr. Carrie. When I'm gone, say nothing about Dr. Carrie. Speak about Dr. Carrie's savior." He passed into eternity June 9, 1834, at the age of 73. He requested that a verse from one of his favorite Isaac Watts hymns be put on his tombstone. "A wretched, poor, and helpless worm, on thy kind arms I fall." William Carey's impact on the missions movement is incalculable. Even in his lifetime, numerous mission societies cropped up. At his death, the mission had about 30 missionaries, 40 native teachers, 45 mission stations and substations, and approximately 600 church members. He laid the foundation for self-sufficient native churches. The Serampore College, which he helped create, is still in operation today. His book, An Inquiry, alone served as the cornerstone for the modern missionary movement, and he hadn't even left England when he wrote it. His biographer included this description by an eyewitness to William Carey's funeral in his book, and it so perfectly encapsulates what everyone must have been feeling after losing such a giant of the faith, but it also serves as a rallying cry, so I want to share it with you. It says, "And now what shall we do? God has taken up our Elijah to heaven. He has taken our master from our head today. But we must not be discouraged. The God of missions lives forever. His cause must go on. The gates of death, the removal of the most eminent, will not impede its progress, nor prevent its successes. Come, we have something also to do than mourn and be dispirited. With our departed leader, all is well. He has finished his course gloriously. But the work now descends on us. Oh, for a double portion of the divine spirit." I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I will see you all after the summer. And as always, thank you for listening to Martyrs and Missionaries. I'm Elise.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.